check session number 11202, reel 8.
Mr. J.C. Rogers, Reel 8. We're talking about life in the box, Mr. Rogers. Did you get any leave?
Yes, a few of the men were sent down to a place called Sidi Bish. That was in Alexandria. And they're taken down by trucks, and they spent two or three nights down there and brought back, and the lucky ones, the time that we're in there, some of them didn't get a leave at all. But if you were lucky enough, you got these 3 days, and I was lucky enough to get the 3 days for myself. I went down there, and it was under canvas at Sidi Bish, and it was like kind of a transit camp, you know, just outside of Alexandria. But on the way back, we were absolutely stupid. About 8 or 10 planes, and there wasn't a great lot of transport, because coming up from Alexandria back up into the what we call the blue, there was a tar macadam road. Wasn't all travelling going over the sandy desert and the rocks. There was a tar macadam road led right up to where we were at Gazar, and just outside of Benghazi. And on the way back, there must have only been about 5 trucks in the convoy, and these troopers came and they gave us a rare do. Well, we jump out of the truck, you know, you leave your truck, you jump out, and you scatter on the sand. And the most terrifying thing about the Stukas is the noise that they make when they're coming down, because they're usually in the sun. And then they come down from the sun, and they make a terrible screech as they come down. And they started, and I looked up, and I saw the bombs actually coming for me. I was lying on the bottom, and I saw them jettison these bombs, and there was 3 of them, and they were just coming. And I said, I'll have to shift from here. And I just got up and I run, and I was lucky, because the bombs did drop in the area where I'd been. And of course, I got a little bit of protection. There was a kind of a palm tree on the side, and I got a bit of protection there. And they staffed us after that. But we were just unlucky. It didn't happen to everybody that went on leave, but we were unlucky when I had my leave. And there wasn't a great lot to do. You could just go in Alexandria and go into the bars and things like that. And the services, canteens, you know, there were the Union Jack clubs and all that kind of thing. The South Africans had a place there, and that's the best you could do, you know. But yes, we did get leave.
Can you recall your exact feelings, your actual feelings, as these bombers bombed and sprayed you?
Well, it's terrifying, and I lay on the sand. They were coming down, you know, after they dropped a few bombs, and you know, we knew they were after us. And I couldn't control my left leg. It must have been the nerve had gone or something, and my left leg was absolutely shaken, and I just couldn't control it. And that was my first experience of action. I'd worse after that, but that particular time, you're feared, there's no doubt about it. I don't think there's any man that goes into action that's not afraid. But the point is, when you do get in, you forget about being afraid, and you just do the thing that you which I can prove afterwards, that you just do the thing that you were trained to do, and you get on with it, and you never think about getting hurt. You always think that it's not going to happen to you, but in any case, you're not even thinking about that, because when you get into action, you just do the job that you're expected of you, and you do it. But every man that goes in action is afraid. when he knows he's going in, and the waiting time, he's afraid. And it's just actually when you get in, or you're attacked, or suddenly, then you react, and the fear goes out of you. And I remember a Colonel Clark. He was the colonel of the 8th Battalion. He wasn't very big, but when we used to get new drafts, and mind, we got plenty of them because we lost a lot of men when we were out there. And when we were getting new drafts, he used to tell them, if you're afraid, you will be afraid, and don't worry about it, because he said, there's not a man, even myself, he said, when we go into action, he said, we're always feared. And I always remember that.
So you had your leave and you went back to the box?
Yes.
Have you any more memories of
that? Yeah, a sad one. And I said, we got aircraft letters once every month. And I got a letter from the missus to say, I had a boy then, he was 3.5 year old. And I got a letter to say that he had tonsillitis and it would affect his breathing. And should he have it out. So without any hesitation, I wrote back and said, by all means, I have his tonsils out. And Major Wood must have been my company commander then. And he sent for me one day, and when I said I wanted to see you, and when I went down, he said, your brother's wrote us a letter. He said, you've had a son that has been going through an operation, and the point where he died, and it was a bit of blow. Couldn't get back home, nothing. He was stuck out there, and that was it. But he was very good. He was as full as what I was myself. And he left us to a colour sergeant. He said, take him away, he said, and I'll write his missus a letter, which we got, and we treasured.
But it must have been a very difficult time.
Oh, it was, yeah. We just had a soldier on.
How did you feel that your comrades, how did they...
They
help you in some way?
They helped, yeah, yes. Especially, I think it was... Colour Sergeant Child, I think it was it was McAdam from Sergeant McAdam from, he was a Gator lad, he was in the fella territorials, and he was a school teacher type of fella. I think he worked in an office, you know, but he was very nice. He didn't look like the ordinary soldier. He'd have been better if they made him a company clerk, although he was a sergeant, mind, and he did his job, but he was too nice to be a sergeant. And he took me under his wing and for a while, and we just had a battle on. The men were getting killed, and he just had a soldier on. So, and I saw the padre, and after, he said, well, he says, you should have, tried to get home. I said, well, I wanted to get home because it was a month after, but still that had happened. But I think that the situation was hopeless. I'd made to fail by everybody, you know. Because my first thought was to get back home to see the missus, and that couldn't do anything about it.
When did the Germans start to be awkward?
Well,
their attacks.
We found out that. He was attacking, I think this in right order. I think we found out he was attacking the Free French at Burak Aim. And that was in the rear of us. And I remember we had a dummy run. We had to go out and help them. That was obvious, we had to go out and help them because they'd had this dummy run before. And they got all the battalions together, and they took them out on this, it was supposed to be a scheme or something. But you see, they just went out and they come back. Now, that particular time, when they were preparing to go out, the trucks was just about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. and the trucks were all getting loaded up and everything to move out. And we got one of these, we used to call them shufty kites, you know, the plane that come across for seeking information for the enemy. And one come across, and we never thought any more about it. And off they went. But I had to stay behind. And there was about eight of us had to stay behind. And Wakenshaw was one of them. And when it was Major Scott, I think it was the Major then, when he was moving off, he says, "Mind," he says, "I'm leaving you in, you're in charge." I didn't have a stripe or anything then. He said, "I'm leaving you in charge." And Wakenshaw was playing war because he was senior soldier, you know. But I said, "Well, it didn't make any difference, work." I said, "You know, there's not going to be a lot to do." So he was nice about it. And I sat there and talked to him. And he told me his whole life story. How when he'd been at school, what a bad lad he'd been. And he said, "I don't even go to church, you know." He said, "And I see you going when you're having your mass." He says, "And I see the lads going." He said, "I always want to go." And he said, "I kind of book up courage." I said, "Well, there's no reason why you shouldn't." I said, "I'll break the ice for you." I said, "I'll go and see the padre and tell him. And he'll be okay." So he said, "Would you?" And he was having that feeling that he wanted to attend to his religious duties again. So I took him up and saw the padre, and the padre said, "Well, leave him with me." And he must have made his peace with God, and he come back, and he was happy. He said, "I've got no money." He said, "I know where I can get you some chocolate and things like that." So I said, "I've got money if you can get some here. I don't know where you're going to get it," but he was a lad like that. So I gave him some money, and away he went, and he come back with two sandbags full of stuff. Because we were only eight of us on our own then, you see, and we just had our party. We were dug in, went into bed. The place was bombed. Terrible. I don't know how many planes coming across, but they were dropping bombs right, left and centre, and there was only eight of us in this camp area, and they were coming down like anything. We were shouting to each other, asking if everybody was all right, playing hell about these fellas and tell them what's this, no good, there was nobody here, don't know why you're bombing. And that happened that particular night. So they must have known that we were in that area. So when we did have to move out to Burakim, they did the same thing again. They lagged up and the way they went off. But they must have known that we were gone, because we went through our own minefields, and there was Major Jackson was in front of me in a 1500 weight, and I was second, and the engineer had his bayonet, and he was feeling for the mines to get through. And we got through the minefield, and then we were walking out in the open country, and the convoy was closing together, you know. And he got worried about it, Major Jackson. He said, "I think I'll go forward," he said, "and tell them to you just hang on, and I'll go forward and get the lot to spread out." And he went forward, and then our first truck for our company. But we hadn't been gone long until the skies just blacked out, and there must have been about 50 bombers. The sun was just going down, and with the so many planes coming across, you couldn't see the land went dark. What happened before a thunderstorm and a thing like that. And they dropped some bombs. Ah, I don't know how many, but we were off our trucks. But lucky for us, where Major Jackson had gone out to tell them that he must have saved a lot of lives, to tell them to spread out, because they got the first lot of it. And I believe he lost his arm. I never saw him anymore, you know. And then, other than when I went through to Durham once, and I saw him there, and we knew then, that we knew he'd lost his arm, and that was the only time I'd seen him. But I didn't get a chance to talk to him. But we got the second load. Of course, when we seen what happened, you know, the trucks were going up, and the smoke and everything, and we off our trucks, and as far away from the truck as you can, because he was aiming for the trucks. And they dropped another lot, and it was terrible. The whole earth shook and everything. Well, we were no good for the French when we got there. We couldn't help them. All I can remember about it was pitch black at night time, and they were wandering around, and nobody seemed to know what they were doing, because they were all disorganized then. And a great big tank commander come round, and he was on a big tank, and he was saying, "What unit are you?" Well, we were always told never to tell anybody what unit we were, so we were just Fred Carnot Army, and anything we used to tell them, and we just said there's some officers over there, and we sent them over. And I believe from then, I wasn't in action at Burrakeen. Somebody else might be able to tell you the battalion might have went into action, but I know we were disorganised, and from then we went back into the box. And then we found that we were surrounded absolutely, and that we had to do something with it. We had to get out. So we loaded the trucks, and I can remember the idea was to, instead of going back, because he'd getting tanks and infantry behind us, instead of going back, the idea was for to go forward and break through what was there, turn into the desert, and then come back out. And I was sitting on my truck, on the back of a truck, and they were blowing ammunition dumps up and everything, you know, before we left, and it was a terrible night, and we were all lit up there, and just waiting for our turn to get through. Well, the lads that went through, they can tell the story all right. I wasn't there. They shot them up and everything. But our lot decided that they were too alert. The Italians and that had been in bed when the first lads went through, but by the time we were going to go through, they were alerted, and somebody decided we wouldn't take that route. We would go back and through Tobruk, because the South Africans were in Tobruk then, but later on it fell, and we went back through Tobruk, and that was a terrifying experience, because when they were chasing us all the way, and we were going in through like kind of wadis and valleys, and he was just coming down with the planes, and I think I must have been off the truck about 14 times getting strafed and bombed to getting out there. And then we finished up on a bit of a peninsula where we were in the water. The tanks had stopped our route out. And the only way, there was a bit of land now, and we were on the beach, and some of the fellas thought about getting into the water to try and get around this bit peninsula, and it was a hopeless situation. And then we went back onto the beach, and we saw something of what was happening, and it was tanks, and we had I think it was 2 pound anti-tank guns then. And they were packed onto a lorry called a portee, and the gun part was facing out over. So somebody had had the bright idea of reversing the portees with the anti-tank gun, because it was only tanks that were stopping us from getting out, to attack the tanks, which they did. And they knocked one or two out, and after they knocked one or two out, the other ones went off. And mind we, I'd lost a lot of trucks, because I saw trucks going up in flames, so I'd taken some people with them. And then, of course, we got back onto our trucks and we made our way out. Our truck broke down, so we had to just leave it and jump on the back of another one. And on the way out, we passed some caves, And I'm sure that there would be some of the Germans would be hiding in there. There were some of the wogs outside of the cave. But we got out and we got away back, and we got into a safe area. And then we were sent up to a spot which might have been south of Murdermatru. And everybody else was coming down the desert, and we been given orders to stop, and we had to, I don't know whether we had to been given orders to fight a rear guard action or what, but I know this. Robinson said to me, he said, if it happens what I think's going to happen, he said, you can shoot me. That was the attitude he was. And that was when we found that no supplies, no water, there were no, all the bottles were empty, and there was panic stations, everybody was going down, there was, all the harbours were getting closed, so there was no way of supplying us. And we were sat out there for a full day, and we had no water or anything. And
did you dig into that position?
No, we were just waiting for orders. There was something going up, and we had to either go back up the line or something for us, and we had to just wait there. And there was an hospital, wasn't very far away from us, that the New Zealanders had, I think it was. But we were actually getting the oil out of our rifle butts and rubbing it on our lips. Our lips were cracking because we couldn't get any water. And while this was going on, everybody was coming down. The Indian team went down, the South Africans come down, and then somebody told me that there was a water truck coming down with the South Africans. I said, stop them. And we stopped them, and we told him. He didn't want to leave it, you know, he was afraid. I said, you can have my number, you can have anything, you know. But he says, I said, you must leave it. I said, you're going to an area where there's tons of water, and we don't know where we're going, and we've got none at all. So he unhisted off, and we filled all the water bottles. And of course, we set off, I don't know, the same night or the night after, and we set off in some direction. But I didn't have a clue where we were going. We'd never been told where we were going. But while we were travelling on the afternoon, there was a convoy in the distance that I could see, and nobody seemed to know who they were, and nobody seemed to be worried who they were. So we travelled until late afternoon, and then we'd found a spot where, and it was at Murdermatru, that's where it was, and we found a spot where we had to dig in and settle ourselves. And I was playing war because they picked a spot where you couldn't dig in. It wasn't sand, it was all hard ground, so you couldn't dig in. And I built a mound of rocks round for my shelter, and it must have been Ed Quarter Company that I was with, and I was put on guard. When I was on guard, there was firing, tracer bullets, there was all kinds flying about, and then they seemed that they were firing at me. So I went and I got the colour sergeant, and I said, and I could hear voices, and foreign voices. So I got the colour sergeant, and I told him, I said, I think we're surrounded here, because I said, I'm getting shot at. And I said, there's people giving orders in foreign languages, and I said, there's tracer bullets and all kinds flying about. He said, it'll be the Indians, man. I said, what about the foreign doing? He said, it'll be Hindustani, they'll be shouting Hindustani at each other. I said, well, I'm sure that their enemies are around about here somewhere. He said, just carry on. So I carried on, and first light, it was there. We were surrounded. We didn't have a cut in hell's chance. And I went down and told the sergeant major, when he wake them all up early morning, and just before first light, I went down and I told the sergeant major, and I think his name was Thompson, And I said, I'm sure we're surrounded. I said, the colour sergeant doesn't seem to think so, but I said, there's going to be some trouble. So I said, you better get yourself back here where we are, you know. And he just lay back and lit a cigarette. He said, get away, man. He said, you're panicking. You've got there. I told them all the story, but they wouldn't believe it. So first light come, and there they were, advancing, hundreds of them, extended line, up the ridge. We were on a kind of a bank, and they were advancing up the ridge. Of course, then it was the colour sergeant has realised what was happening. So, brave me, I said, well, shall we open up? Well, what else can you say? You've got enemy advancing towards you. There's only the colour sergeant, myself, and the driver of the truck. But I said, shall I open up? He said, no, don't fire from here. He said, the headquarter company, he says, is behind that ridge at the back. I didn't know anything about the layout of who was where or what was happening. And he said, when they put the next smoke screen down, get up and run back over the top of the ridge. So I got this driver and I told him, I said, when they drop the next smoke screen, up and we'll run back. He said, I'll have to get my truck. He was a Royal Army Service Corps driver and he wasn't one of our own. And he knew his first duty was to get his truck out. I said, you can't get that. I said, you've had it now, you could tell. So we waited for the smoke coming, and then we were up and we run. And the rifle fire and machine gun fire and all kinds was coming right, left and centre. And it was hitting the stones. It was hard ground, you know, where we were. And it was hitting the stones in front of me when I was running. And dropping down flat and then waiting a bit and then getting up again and having another run. And then I got hit. I felt a sting in the right foot. And I dropped down, and full of pain, I dropped down, but I worked my big toe. It was my big toe, and I worked it, and it was nothing wrong with it. So I said, well, I'm still all right. I haven't been hit, you know. So I had been hit, but not wounded. So I dashed the little bit, last bit, over the mound of the hill, and I just threw myself over, and there was the second in command. I believe we'd lost our colonel. And there was a second in command, and I don't know whether it was slight or not, but John Willie, big John Willie Robinson, he was there, and there was a crowd of officers having a kind of a meeting together. They seemed to be all right over the ridge that dug in, but I've never seen anything like it in all my life. The mortar, they must have been taken unawares. The mortar pit was on the left when I'd got over there. And there's a full corporal there that was in the Territorial Army. I don't know his name. And they were shelling like the devil then. The whole area was getting shelled. And he was telling the fella to carry on with the brewing up. He just they must have been taken unaware because he was brewing the tea, this fella, and he was telling them to carry on with the brewing up, you know, don't let, you know, you weren't going to let the Germans spoil his cup of tea kind of style. And they were firing the mortar to start, you know, they were firing the mortar all right. And he got hit and in his KD shirt, and just one little red, I can see it vividly, one little red hole in his right hand side of his chest. And that lad was shouting and what he was going, you know, about the getting on with the tea and giving the orders for the fire the mortar, and he couldn't care less.